afternoon. We're going to start promptly because we have a very full agenda. I'd like to welcome you to this session and thank you for coming. My name is Hillel Cohen. I'm with the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and I'll be facilitating this session. I also would like to thank the Socialist Caucus for sponsoring the session, and the Labor Caucus and the Public Health Education and Health Promotion Section for its endorsement. This will be the first presentation, and because of the tightness of time, I'm going to be skipping a good number of the slides. I'll just skip through them. There is a handout with all the slides on the chair in the back, though. There may be some, I think there's still some left. If we run out of them, I'll be passing around a sign-up sheet. Just check it if you would like to get the full slides in the mail, in the email. You can also send me an email, and we'll send the handouts for all the presentations of the presenters who wish to distribute them. Ordinary influenza is a serious public health issue, and there are many thousands of deaths worldwide, as many as 300,000 deaths every year, and in the United States, estimated between 30 and 40,000 deaths every year from ordinary influenza. There have been, in the last 100 years, three recorded pandemics. That's worldwide epidemics of influenza. The by far the largest one was the first in 1918-1919, with some estimates of as many as 50 to 100 million deaths during that time. The subsequent ones were some substantially smaller. And the reasonable perception is that if it's happened in the past, it can happen again. And concern about pandemic flu was heightened with the outbreak of avian flu in 1997, which is continuing today. So far, there has not been a jump from transmission to among birds to human transmission. No one knows if it will happen or if it can happen, but certainly there's a possibility and there's concern about that. But so far, although there's been extensive economic losses, including small-scale farmers in Asia who've sustained a lot of losses, the human casualties have been relatively few. There's been a great deal of concern and focus on on disaster preparedness, especially after the September 11th attacks in 2001. And FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security got a great deal of money after that. But in 2005, after the heck of a job that FEMA did in the New Orleans and the Gulf, the Katrina and Rita hurricanes exposed substantial failures in disaster planning, emergency response, and other issues. Those failures have been widely discussed. What has been discussed less widely are that the basis of many of those failures could be found in institutional racism, class divisions, and other issues that are not very popular among policy planners. But these two were exposed by the hurricanes and the responses. Perhaps in response or to take attention away from the failures of the response to Katrina, and perhaps just to add to the arsenal of scare stories that this administration has used for political purposes, the Bush administration launched a major public relations campaign about the dangers of pandemic flu just a month after Katrina in October of 2005, promising a great deal of money with the focus and attention on vaccine production and antivirals for avian flu, or as it's also called, H5N1. The CDC, the World Health Organization, and other organizations, including APHA with its current program, Getting Ready program, have also been paying a great deal of attention to it. And it's in this context that the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services have published what they call interim guidelines or interim guidance plan. The CDC plan is widely available. You can get it at the CDC table in the exposition hall. It's on the web. If you need the, you can, if you look at the slides later, you'll get the website. It's widely available. Clearly, the authors of the CDC plan had Katrina in mind when they wrote it. In addition to explicit references, they also created what they call a pandemic severity index, which has five categories modeled precisely with the five-category hurricane scale. But having a plan does not mean having a plan that will work. Many people are not aware that there was a hurricane preparedness plan in place in New Orleans that had been publicly announced and with wide publicity a full year before Katrina in 2004. And that plan successfully predicted the failed levees, at least 100,000 unable to evacuate, people stranded on rooftops. These predictions were right on target, but all of the action proposals, all of the action plans did not work. They were total failures. I'm going to skip through the slides that detail the 2004 hurricane preparedness plan. Please look at it at the handouts. It makes for interesting reading after the fact, comparing the what the plan suggested and what the realities were. So we're going to focus on the CDC's interim plan, and again, because of time, really focusing on just two of the 4 points that they raise. The pandemic mitigation framework, which is what they call it, has four main interventions: isolation and treatment, voluntary home quarantine, the closure of schools and childcare centers, and the use of other, what they call, social distancing measures. I'm going to skip through the first one. Again, you can look at the handouts. There are obvious problems with it, but these are replicated in the second, and I'm going to focus here. This is a really main element of this plan, and that is voluntary home quarantine. In other words, people who are diagnosed with pandemic flu or think they have it should stay at home. And the word voluntary is a very nice word. It means freedom of choice. It has lots of good connotations. The problem is that it also has a subtext of what euphemistically is called individual responsibility, but which also has a less benign subtext of you're on your own. The big problem that everybody saw with voluntary evacuation is that while many were able to take advantage of it, many were not. The plan of voluntary evacuation was the hurricane's coming, get in your car and go. But for those who did not have cars, for those who did not have gas for their cars, and for those who did not have a place to go or who were taking care of people who were not able to evacuate, this plan didn't work for them. And while staying at home seems a lot easier than evacuating, staying at home has serious obstacles as well. How will quarantined individuals get food, medicine, and supplies if they're staying in their house and they're not, if they live alone or if other members of their family also are quarantined, so-called, how will they get the food and supplies that they need? Also, we can expect breakdowns in communication and the delivery of services and goods in all the communities because absenteeism would be widespread. And if voluntary quarantine fails, which it is likely to do, will there be mandatory quarantine And how will that affect the poor and minority communities? Will they be occupied with police and military, as with the Blackwater mercenaries that were sent into New Orleans? The voluntary quarantine plan also calls for medications, prophylactic medications, or antivirals, providing that there are sufficient quantities, et cetera, et cetera. But while recognizing the likelihood that there won't be an effective antiviral or not sufficient quantities or means of distributing them, the plan says nothing about changing that. And all these problems will be compounded by the questions of class and race. Which neighborhoods will have adequately stocked pharmaceuticals? Which neighborhoods will get or will have distribution points set up? Which neighborhoods will have access to doctors to write prescriptions if prescriptions are needed for these medications? Not all neighborhoods are equal. Another major part of the plan is the closure of schools and childcare centers, because it's widely known that these are places where infection can be easily transmitted amongst children, and all sorts of infections happen all the time. And it's very easy to close schools. An administrative order can just say the schools are closed, and within hours, they're closed. But there's a big problem. Where do the children go? They go home. And what about the families with working parents? What will they do? Should they leave the children home alone when they go to work? Will they face prosecution for abandonment, as sometimes happens? Or should they stay at home and risk losing their jobs, or certainly losing pay for those days that they're at home watching their kids? There are other social distancing measures that are outlined in the plan. Just very briefly, they mention public transportation. Yes, crowded conditions on buses or metros or subways. So the recommendation is to avoid those. Again, who can readily get to work without public transportation? There's differences in abilities. Those who have other alternate means, cars and so on, and those who don't. And this does not take that into account. They also describe different types of methods that employers and workplaces can reduce the interpersonal contact. But all jobs are not the same. And some jobs, especially low-paid service jobs, require face-to-face contact. And what if employers do go along with it, or because of lack of customers or other disruptions in the economy without supplies or services, that people are let go, they're laid off? What happens to the paychecks, the people who live paycheck to paycheck? What will happen? Some people may be eligible for unemployment insurance. Others may be eligible for disability. But many, many workers do not qualify for these. Not only undocumented workers, the marginal economies, the underground economies, and many self-employed, and many, many others. There's a reference to a recommendation that people should telecommute or telework. And this so clearly reveals the class bias of the people writing the plan. Yes, upper-level bureaucrats can work from home, academics like myself. Yes, we can work from home by telephone and by computer. But that's a minority of the workforce. How do you get grocery supplies delivered by the computer? You can order them, you can't deliver them or move them through the warehouses. Garbage cannot be tele-removed. It's a blind sight, a blindness to the vast majority of working people whose jobs do not allow for that. And of course, a pandemic flu will be different from other disasters. Hurricanes, fires, earthquakes, tornadoes. These happen in very short amount of time. Yes, the aftermath can be quite prolonged, but the crisis itself is within a few hours or a day or two at the most, maybe a week. But with pandemic flu, we're talking about not hours or days, but weeks and months. Are the schools going to be closed for months? Are people going to be out of work for months? and this will create hardships and many other problems that are not being addressed. We'll have another talk about the possibility of military intervention, but we should be aware that emergency preparedness laws give white executive authority with potential for racist abuses that we've seen in New Orleans. We've seen them in New York after some of the blackouts. And again, this is something not being considered. Last month, you may have missed it, Bush introduced a national strategy for homeland security and a presidential directive on public health and medical preparedness. Filled with platitudes, unfunded mandates, dependence on the private sector, in fact, everything except providing resources for the real needs that people will have. But we can all be at ease because it will establish a task force made up of the Bush cabinet members who will, quote, develop a plan. And I'm relieved, aren't you? In conjunction with it, they announced flu vaccine priorities, let alone the fact that we don't know if there is a pandemic, what virus strain it would be. It could be H5N1, it could be something else, it could be not flu. So development of a vaccine is going to take time, and then we've had the experience, and there'll be a discussion about the regular disruptions of production and distribution of vaccines, of the regular flu vaccine that we know so much about. Every year it has to be remade, and these have not been regular. So besides that fact, this plan does have some interesting things. I don't know if you can read it from a distance, but it shows where the focus is going to be. That very first number of tier one who gets the vaccine first, it's called deployed and mission critical personnel. That's a euphemism for the military. 700,000, that's not the whole military. They have others who are not deployed. But where will these military be deployed, and what exactly will their mission be? Another interesting thing, a side point on this document, if you notice the second line, I don't have a pointer, but it provides for vaccination for 150,000 workers in the intelligence services. Did you know that there were 150,000 people working in the various government spy agencies? So many intelligence workers, so little intelligence. But it's easy to criticize a plan, any plan. The question is there a better way? Can we identify alternate proposals? I want to suggest a few. I think many of these people would support free health care for all the time. But at the very least, free, if in the event of a pandemic, free health care for all pandemic-related illnesses, whether it's diagnosis, treatment, prophylaxis, whatever. It all should be free on an emergency basis. Job security. All workers who have to stay home due to their own illness or the illness of members of their family, taking care of kids, if this voluntary quarantine is going to work, you have to provide that job security. You also have to provide a guaranteed income for anyone who misses work due to illness, or misses work or is laid off due to the crisis. There would need to be a moratorium on mortgages and rents and utilities so that people are not thrown out of their homes because they don't have an income to pay the rent or not enough, or have their lights and heat shut off in the midst of this crisis. A freeze on prices of all necessities to prevent gouging. Food and medicine distributions that would be federally funded but community implemented. And civilian patrols to maintain order and orderly distribution of the goods and services that would be needed. And how do we pay for all of this? Not so difficult. Transfer the multi-billion-dollar war budget to public health and these emergency needs. But is it impractical? Are these impractical suggestions? I'd suggest that we compare it to the practicality of the CDC's preparedness plan that depends on this, 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 and most of all, it depends on the voluntary support and cooperation from employers, corporations, banks, landlords, and vendors to voluntarily give up their profits for the greater good. That's what I call impractical. That's not going to happen. We need a plan that can be implemented if there is indeed an emergency. In the interest of time, I won't read that. Let me entertain one or two questions and.